Perkelbach v. SEC, 13-2896. Mr. Moylan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is James Moylan, M-O-Y-L-A-N. I represent the petitioner in this case, Carl M. Perkelbach. He's appealing from a decision of the United States Securities and Exchange Commission affirming the decision of FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority's National Adjudicatory Council's decision increasing the penalty that was imposed by FINRA's hearing panel of a 6-month suspension and a $25,000 fine for a failure to supervise to a complete bar in any capacity with any FINRA member firm. The record will show that Mr. Perkelbach was involved in one prior disciplinary proceeding in 1999 with the Illinois Securities Department. After this case was filed, after the FINRA case was filed that we hear on, FINRA brought two more actions, which Mr. Perkelbach just settled without admitting or denying the allegations because he had already been barred from the industry. One of the critical facts in this case, I believe, is the fact that Ms. Lowry, the customer here, told Mr. Murphy and Mr. Perkelbach that she needed at least $10,000 a month. She also told them that she did not want her Procter & Gamble stock called away that she received from her father in trust. That fact is critical. The hearing panel gave it very short shrift. The National Adjudicatory Council gave it very short shrift, as did the SEC. But the $10,000 a month back in the context of July of 2002 is important because Mr. Perkelbach is aware that Ms. Lowry has given Mr. Murphy instructions to be aggressive. To generate $10,000 a month trading securities requires aggressive action.
Mr. Moylan, I'm confused. It sounds like you want to argue that no sanction should have been imposed at all. Is that right?
If we get to 28 U.S.C. 2462, that's correct.
I thought you're telling us about the merits of the underlying disciplinary action. Is that what you want to argue about? Because I really didn't see that much about that in your brief.
Right, I just want to put it in context with respect to the charge against Mr. Perkelbach was a failure to supervise. And I'm trying to put
it in. Do you want to debate the FINRA findings?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, why don't you focus on the issues you briefed?
Yes, sir. The claims against Mr. Perkelbach, the one claim against Mr. Perkelbach is a failure to supervise, a single charge of failure to supervise. There was a claim against the firm for failing to have adequate supervisory procedures in place. The Business Conduct Committee of FINRA denied that claim and dismissed that charge. Accordingly, what we're talking about is the fact that Perkelbach Investment Securities had in place a system of supervision. The question is, did Mr. Perkelbach exercise supervision? With respect to a single charge of failure to supervise, if you put that in the middle, and then you go to the other side of the continuum, you say, well, not only was there a failure to supervise, but Mr. Perkelbach was complicit in Mr. Murphy's activities. Mr. Perkelbach saw to it that there was no books or records maintained with respect to the activities of Ms. Lowry's account. All the other aspects of it compound the problem, and perhaps a failure to supervise can result in a more serious sanction that was imposed. The other side of the continuum is, what did Mr. Perkelbach do in connection with the failure to supervise? The record is clear that the firm sent 8 activity letters to...
Mr. Moylan, I thought we were here to talk about the statute of limitations issue. Did I miss something?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Are you getting to it?
I'm getting to it.
Okay.
Thank you. I'll get to it right now. When FINRA, the Department of Enforcement, filed this case in August of 2008, it said that commencing in July 2002, when Ms. Lowry's account was transferred and assigned to Mr. Murphy, that from that point forward, whatever went on, any activity in the account at that point was violative of the rules and regulations of FINRA. FINRA's expert witness, Mark Allaire, at the hearing, testified that in July 2002, that's when the date, when everything went, we began to go south.
You agree it's a continuing duty to supervise, right?
I agree it's a continuing duty to supervise.
Okay. Let me. We're not getting to at least what concerns me. We've read your briefs, okay? In the statute of limitations, in your opening brief, I didn't see any effort to address FINRA's and the SEC's conclusion, alternative conclusion, that whether the federal statute of limitations applies could not possibly matter because most of the conduct for which the sanctions was imposed occurred within the five-year period. Now, that gives rise to two questions in my mind. First, haven't you waived any challenge to that alternative conclusion? Second, if we reach the merits of it, then we'll talk about the merits, okay?
I don't believe that we waived it, Your Honor. We have maintained that the action was barred under 28 U.S.C. 2462 since we filed our affirmative defenses to the initial complaint filed by FINRA.
Where did you address the alternative holding that says it doesn't matter whether 2462 applies?
Your Honor, 2462 does apply because if you look at the Gabelli case.
Right, and the SEC and FINRA said, if it applies, fine, the result's the same. Where did you address that in your opening brief?
I believe, Your Honor, we addressed it throughout the brief, saying that the conduct that was at issue here, the way it was teed up by FINRA, the way FINRA's expert witness testified, and how they've maintained it at various times in their briefs, both to the NAC and to the SEC, was that the whole problem started in July of 2002. Under the Gabelli case, that is, there's not a discovery period. It's more of a repose.
So your theory then, if we get to the merits, again, I don't see that in your opening brief, but if we get to that issue on the merits, is your position that if you can get away with a consistent pattern of violations of FINRA rules for more than 5 years, then you can continue that pattern with impunity?
No, the other is, I think it's the opposite, Your Honor, is that FINRA can't bring an action against for you after 5 years.
Based on things that have happened within the five-year period?
Your Honor,
we agreed this was a continuing duty to supervise, and FINRA found a continuing failure to supervise up through, through June of 07 in the Martinelli case, FIA account, and through February 06 in the Lowry account, which were obviously well within the five-year period. Why isn't that failure to supervise actionable and sanctionable?
Because as I read 2462, it goes back to the period of time when the violation first occurred. And that violation occurred
in
July of
2002. If it's a continuing violation, that's why I'm going back. You seem to be saying, if I can get this pattern started and get away with it for 5 years, no consequences. I'm immune. That can't be right, can it?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so why is this different? Why doesn't that accurately describe your case?
Because of the way that it was pled, and the fact that Mr. Birkelbach's supervision during that period of time has to be looked at in real time. What was he seeing? What was going on? They were doing all the appropriate. He was doing all the appropriate things. He was taking appropriate affirmative steps.
You're arguing the merits now, right?
Yes.
But arguing the merits is not really a response to the statute of limitations point, right? The assumption of the statute of limitations is that the law was violated, the FINRA regulations were violated. We've got those findings. We're not challenging them in this appeal. So we've got findings that say Mr. Birkelbach was violating the law, violating FINRA regulations, beginning with Lowry in July of 02, continuing through February of 06, more than two-thirds of that time within the five-year limitations period. And all the Martinelli behavior is within the five-year limitations period.
Yes, Your Honor. Martinelli is, again, $5,000 involved. It's over a three-month period of time. The accounts open. The
so we shouldn't worry about that.
Well, I think in the grand scheme of things, it's de minimis compared to the Lowry situation, and we didn't spend a lot of time addressing it in our briefs.
So you agree that the Martinelli claim was timely?
Martinelli claim was timely, and I would argue that to bar a person for life for activity that occurred over a three-month period of time is pretty draconian.
And then the Lowry account continues within the statute of limitations period from August of 2003 through February of 2006, more than two-thirds of the total time that she had her account.
Yes, Your Honor. That's
so
correct.
What am I not getting about your statute of limitations theory?
Well, I was trusting we addressed that properly in the brief. See, I'm going to be out of time here in a second.
This is critical.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
Please answer the question.
Your Honor, the only thing I can tell you is that as I read 28 U.S.C. 2462 and I read Gabelli, the claim accrued at the time the activity occurred in July going forward, and that to start and say we can stop here and start here, you'd never be able to get a statute of limitations argument.
If you continue breaking the rules, that would be right. I mean, we see this all the time, for example, in hostile environment. Let's say it's a sexual harassment of an employee by a supervisor. That often builds up over time. It's a continuing violation. And the statute of limitations may have run as to some earlier incidents, but there's no problem in imposing liability for the incidents that are timely when suit is brought. Is this different?
Then you would look at it from the point of the mitigation involved and the time period involved. Is if you start the clock at some other period other than the beginning and say that there was still violative conduct, does it still warrant a bar for life from the securities business?
So are you saying the SEC and FINRA, because more than 5 years had passed from the 2002 incidents, were required to ignore that evidence?
No, they weren't required to ignore the evidence, but they were required to abide by the period that FINRA was the one that teed up the complaint to say that this whole thing started in July of 2002. We didn't do that. Their expert witness said the same thing. My last point, very quickly, is that from 1935, when the Maloney Act was passed and amended the Securities Exchange Act in 1934 to create the National Association of Securities Dealers, which is the predecessor to FINRA, no one has ever been barred for life for a mere charge, one charge of a failure to supervise. And I believe that the sentence passed upon Mr. Breckelbach for that one failure to supervise in this particular case cannot be justified under the law.
Mr. Marlin, let me ask you a question. Assuming we say that all the conduct within the five-year statute of limitations period is actionable, do you contest that the conduct within that 5 years support the SEC findings of violations, not sanctions, just violations?
No, Your Honor.
You agree that it does?
I agree with you on that. I simply believe that the sanctions that were imposed at that point were draconian and not warranted in the public interest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Prony?
May it please the Court. The petition on review only presents two issues. First, whether 2462 barred FINRA's disciplinary proceedings against Mr. Breckelbach, and second, whether the bar imposed in this case was excessive or oppressive. The answer to both of those questions is no. Starting with the 2462 issue, the Commission specifically concluded that Breckelbach repeatedly failed to supervise Murphy, as this Court has pointed out, within 5 years of the complaint. And if I understood opposing counsel correctly, he seems to concede that the conduct within that period would be sufficient in order to maintain the violations. And as the Court also pointed out, Mr. Breckelbach failed to even address or mention the Commission's finding that he repeatedly failed to supervise Murphy within 5 years of the complaint in his opening brief, and he certainly made no argument that the commission's finding was somehow erroneous. The only issue then is whether the sanction imposed in this case was excessive or oppressive. It was not, and substantial evidence supports the commission's finding that the sanction was not excessive or oppressive. To start, the FINRA sanction guidelines themselves indicate that a bar is appropriate in cases of particularly egregious supervisory violations. And as both FINRA and the commission concluded in this case, Mr. Birkelbach's conduct was particularly egregious. Indeed, he engaged in numerous supervisory violations over a multi-year period. He ignored numerous and obvious warnings, including five that were contained in activity letters that were produced by BIS's compliance officer within the limitations period, including one from November of 2003 that noted that Murphy's trading had become so excessive that it had actually generated more than $250,000 in commissions year to date. Mr. Birkelbach was also found to have acted with intent, as the commission found, because there's no way he could have ignored so many obvious flags and done nothing in response. In addition to that, although Mr. Birkelbach seems to contend his other disciplinary infractions are not part of the record before this court and weren't part of the record before FINRA, the fact is his other disciplinary infractions are part of the record, and they were part of the record before the commission. For instance, his censure and suspension by Illinois regulators for churning, excessively trading, trading without authorization, and engaging in unsuitable transactions in five of his own separate customer accounts in 1999 is listed and described in his CRD disclosure, which is reproduced in the commission's appendix at pages 169 through 171 and was part of the record before the commission. In addition to that, during the proceedings before the commission, FINRA moved to introduce evidence that Mr. Birkelbach had committed other supervisory and disclosure failures, and the commission granted FINRA's motion to consider that evidence. In fact, Mr. Birkelbach consented to allowing that evidence to come into the record, and the commission could rely on that evidence in sustaining the sanction here. Now, lastly, Mr. Birkelbach seems to contend that his sanction is in some way outside of the norm. I believe he just said that a failure to supervise has never been used in order to bar somebody from the industry. Well, that's not true. The Second Circuit, as we point out in our brief, actually affirmed a bar in a case involving failure to supervise because the individual, like Mr. Birkelbach, had an extensive history of failing to follow the rules designed to protect investors, not just in a supervisory capacity, but also in a general capacity. And the fact is, Mr. Birkelbach, though he cites a handful of cases for the proposition that this is somehow an unwarranted sanction or it's excessive or oppressive, the vast majority of those cases that he cites, none of which he ever really bothers to analyze or discuss in any detail, the vast majority of those cases involve violations that took place over the course of less than a year, and they certainly didn't also involve a multi-year pattern of misconduct like you have here, where the individual acted with intent, where the individual enabled churning to take place in two separate customer accounts, and again, where the individual, like Mr. Birkelbach, had a history of failing to follow the rules designed to protect investors in both the general and a supervisory capacity. And unless the court has any questions.
I'm curious about some other things that you said in your brief, Mr. Browning. You argued, for example, that the lifetime bar was not a penalty, but only that would be subject to 2462, but only a preventive, protective measure, right? Remedial measure. How does one, under your theory, tell the difference between a penalty and a remedy?
One way would be the D.C. Circuit argument, or the D.C. Circuit cited in Johnson. The D.C. Circuit said that generally a suspension in that case, or you can apply that to a bar, a suspension or a bar may generally resemble a penalty because it's certainly uncomfortable for the individual who's suspended or barred. However, if that finding is based on a finding of competence or fitness or degree of risk posed going forward, then it's not a penalty.
So, now I mean, all the three of us here have a fair amount of experience with criminal sentencing. And usually that includes a punitive element, a remedial element, a rehabilitation element, a deterrence element. But I would have a hard time saying any of it is not punishment or a penalty. Does the determination of whether a lifetime bar in the securities industry depend upon the label that the sanctioning entity imposes upon it?
I think that could be part of it, but I think what, again, what the DC
So if the SEC just says this isn't a penalty, this is a protective remedial measure, then it doesn't count?
That, so what Johnson, for instance, said, Johnson said exactly what you're proposing. The D.C. Circuit found that the SEC characterized this as a remedial measure in one conclusory paragraph. And what Johnson said, because there's no analysis there to indicate that this was based on sort of a competence finding or a finding of fitness or a degree of risk posed going forward, that's what made it a penalty. And the 11th Circuit in Coughlin, which is another case we cite, sort of took that same analysis and said, well, in that case, because I believe it was the NTSB, the NTSB's assessment was based on sort of a competence or degree of fitness going forward, that's not a penalty. And that's consistent with how, for instance, state Supreme Courts have long characterized licenses, revocations and suspensions and stuff like that, because it's not based so much what you're concerned with in a traditional statute of limitations framework where conduct is X and you want to punish or award damages for X. Rather, it's based on the competence of the individual going forward. And Mr. Birkelbach, as the Commission and FINRA concluded, again, has a history of failing to follow the rules.
So if a state Supreme Court disbars an attorney because of something that happened 20 years earlier, and it says we're doing this to protect the public, that would be treated not as a penalty or punishment, but as something much more benign.
In that hypothetical, the fact that it was 20 years before, that's something that certainly could be taken into consideration in determining whether it's a penalty. At some point, it's become so far removed and it happened so long ago that you can certainly say it's no longer remedial because 20 years have passed. It doesn't show fitness or competence going forward if the individual has no other history of disciplinary infractions. That's part of the assessment. What you have here, again, is a multi-year period well within the statute of limitations period that showed that he's unable to perform the duties.
I also wanted to ask you about your theory that 2462 doesn't apply to FINRA sanctions at all. Obviously, you're familiar with the course of litigation around the country that has a kind of heads we win, tails you lose flavor to it for self-regulatory organizations, right?
Are you referring to the immunity case law?
Well, there's immunity, there's due process, et cetera, right? That is where the SROs get all the immunity of a government agency and none of the responsibilities. Which is troubling. I don't know if this is the case where we try to wrestle that to the ground or not, but let me ask you, does any law prohibit an SRO from discriminating in its enforcement on the basis of, let's say, race or religion or political affiliation?
Off the top of my head, I know that there is a statutory requirement. I don't recall whether we cited it in our brief or not, but there is a statutory requirement, and I can provide the citation. It's 15 U.S.C. 780-3 that requires that an SRO provide fair process and an opportunity for an individual to defend themselves.
That's but procedural.
It's a procedure that may be enforced by the SEC to ensure that SRO does actually follow the proper procedure. But if the question, dealing with race in particular, which is the question you raised.
And political affiliation, which is, let's say, gets us away from any Title VII concerns.
So if you, Judge Friendly's decision in Solomon actually sort of differentiates between the two and says, well, what you had in that case, which was a due process argument, and he actually distinguishes, I believe, in the race context and says, well, if the SRO were, if NYSE were discriminating on the basis of race or this was a racial type thing, it would be different.
So what's the difference?
The difference between?
Well, look, the Constitution does not prohibit private race discrimination. So why would race be different for a self-regulatory organization?
Part of,
if it's private.
Well, part of what determines whether or not there's, for instance, state action or a state interest there is the type of action that's involved. So it's a sort of a case-specific. I think that's what Judge Friendly's talking about in Solomon, is you have to look at things case by case. And if we go back to the antitrust.
So race... For race purposes, we would treat the SRO as a governmental entity?
I certainly think that if you had an SRO that were discriminating on the basis of race, the SEC has the power to step in at that point, I believe would. It's not a question.
Well, one would hope, but in terms of whether the SRO is acting as a governmental actor, a state actor, why does the form, the type of discrimination make a difference? And suppose it's political affiliation. Suppose it's religion. Obviously, Wall Street had a long, long history of religious segregation.
Again, except to say that it's context-specific, and the hypothetical, I'm sort of stuck in the position of saying the hypothetical would never occur because, again, the SEC...
Because we're good guys.
Well, I think the government is certainly entitled to a presumption of good faith sort of in that context.
Is the SRO?
I believe the SRO would be, too, but if for some reason the SRO violated the good faith, again, the commission has the power to sanction the SRO.
You've pointed to the statutory requirement that the SRO provide fair process. Do you think that's constitutionally required?
There is no... The only courts that have addressed the issue, there is no due process requirement. So
Congress could authorize FINRA to end a person's career without a hearing.
Well, it's not Congress authorizing FINRA. FINRA, as Judge Friendly points out in Solomon, and Jones pointed out in the Fourth Circuit, this is a pre-existing system. It's a system that existed before the Maloney Act, before Congress stepped in. Self-regulatory organizations had self-policing, self-enforcement powers long before the Maloney Act, and what Congress has done here is they stepped in and they basically have ensured the process is fair and ensured that it's robust. But Congress didn't override a pre-existing system. And is the Fourth Circuit...
The pre-existing system would pose some antitrust problems, or at least issues, right, if it didn't have the blessing of Congress.
That's correct.
So could Congress authorize this self-regulatory organization to end a person's career without a hearing?
Again, the problem is that Congress isn't authorizing the SRO in this case. But
I'm asking you, you're telling us the SRO is a private entity, not subject to 2462. I'm trying to explore the consequences of that theory. If it's a private entity, then Congress could authorize it not to to end a career without a hearing. Or am I missing something?
No, I think you're probably right. But again, that would be context specific. And what we're talking about in this case, which is 2462, you don't necessarily jump from one to the other. It doesn't necessarily follow that because one is true, Congress can do the other. There is no due process right before an SRO, and courts have said that again and again. So if it's a due process question, then courts have rejected that idea. So if the question is framed in terms of Congress authorizing...
Well, I mean, courts have said a lot of things in this area, and the treatment of SROs is inconsistent and has this heads we win, tails you lose flavor to it. Right?
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think what you have here is something that's context specific. So if you look at, for instance, the immunity
case. Well, when do the SROs lose?
Well, they have, in the context of antitrust, they did lose at least one case where weren't found to have antitrust immunity to the extent, I believe it was Silver, where they're treated, where it was a boycott type thing. I don't remember the details of that case in specifically, but I can certainly submit a letter.
That was Silver against New York Stock Exchange.
I believe that's right.
Long ago, yeah. Okay. Thanks. I don't think it's necessary.
Anything else? Thank you. Mr. Moylan, 2 minutes if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Carl Birkelbach is portrayed as being a bad guy. He's been in this business he's registered in this business back into the early 80s. He had one disciplinary action in 1999 with the Illinois Securities Department, and counsel argues, and in the brief they argue, that he can't follow the rules. I would argue the opposite. Number one, I would argue that because he had to face those sanctions, had to pay a fine, pay attorney's fees, make restitution, his antenna was up about complying with the rules. Secondly, with respect to the application of 28 U.S.C. 2462 to a self-regulatory organization, that statute has been applied to corporations and other situations, other institutions, where there was no statute of limitations. So the fact that you are a SRO does not mean you're immune from 2462. 2462 applies. And I would ask this court to give that careful consideration when you make this determination in this case. You said you want to, are we going to wrestle that issue? I trust you will wrestle with that issue in this opinion. The last thing is that Mr. Berkelbacher was barred in all capacities. He was registered as a registered representative. He was a municipal securities principal. He was a financial operations principal. He was all these other, had all these other registrations, and they barred him from everything without one iota of evidence that pertained to any of his other capacities. I just think that's way out of line. I believe that Mr. Berkelbach Mr. Berkelbach here to reclaim his reputation, if you will. He had that one blemish on his record in 1999. The other ones that counsel refers to occurred after this case was filed and Mr. Berkelbach was barred. So we just settled the case without him being denying anything. There's no sense in fighting those. And he seeks to have the SEC's opinion vacated and his reputation restored. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to both counsel, and that case will be taken.